Day late. Without explanation, a spokesman for the Haitian Electoral Council declared that Michel Martelly, also known as Sweet Mickey, will run against the former First Lady, Merlan Maniga. Preliminary results had the ruling party's candidate, Jude Celestin, in the runoff instead of Martelly. The release of those results sparked riots that shut down Port-au-Prince for 3 days. In December, Martelly, Maniga, and 10 other presidential candidates denounced the polls as riddled with fraud and called for the elections to be canceled. Martelly and Maniga both eventually backed away from their calls to redo the balloting. Today's announcement paves the way for a runoff to be held on March 20th. Jason Beaubien, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials are down 22 points. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world on the web at hewlett.org.
You're one of 170 million Americans who stay informed or get inspired.
One of 170 million Americans who use public media every month. That's more than half the country. Now public media needs your support.
Make sure the programming you need in your community stays in your community. Learn more about federal funding for public media at 170millionamericans.org.
WILL programs are made possible by Bevere Cafe. Bevere Cafe offers specialty coffees, breakfast featuring a choice of cold and hot breakfast items from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m., and to-go sandwiches and salads for lunch. Bevere Cafe is student-operated in Bevere Hall, corner of Gregory and Goodwin, Urbana.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The first hour, we have an archive for you. We'll get that in just a second. Here I do, however, again, want to mention that hour two, we will be live. Celeste Quinn will be hosting the program, and we'll be doing a show that we call Computers and You, something that we do every month to talk about new trends in technology, safe computing, and also to take your questions. Peter Kimball with the Center for Teaching Excellence at the U of I Urbana-Champaign will be the guest, and Celeste Quinn will be the host. So that's hour number two. In the first hour, we go to a show from the archives. It's a program we first broadcast January 5th. So for this first hour, we will not be taking calls. Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for the program, Harriet Williamson, Jason Croft, is at the controls. In May of 1943, an American bomber, B-24 bomber, went down in the Pacific. Of the crew of 11, three people survived: the tail gunner, the pilot, and the bombardier, a man named Louis Zamprini. Some of these men spent 47 days in a tiny life raft out on the water. Some people think that, in fact, might be the record for the amount of time people have spent in this kind of condition. Then the men were picked up by the Japanese, and he went on to spend 2 years as a Japanese prisoner of war, undergoing brutal, brutal treatment. It was something, though, that he survived. He went on to become a well-known motivational speaker, and that's just part of the remarkable life story of this man, which really began with him being a competitive runner in high school, a world-class runner. He competed in the 1936 Berlin Olympics. All of this, this amazing story, is told in a new book by our guest for this hour, Laura Hillenbrand. The title of the book is Unbroken, A World War II Story of Survival, Resilience, and Redemption. Random House is the publisher. Laura Hillenbrand, this is her second book. Her first was a big bestseller, Seabiscuit, An American Legend, which was about the racehorse. Seabiscuit was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award, won a number of other awards. It inspired a film, and certainly a lot of people read this book. She was on this program when that book came out, and we're very happy to have her back to talk with us about the new book, Unbroken. And Ms. Hillenbrand, hello.
Hello. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, thank you. I cannot quite believe that it's been, has it been 7 years since Seabiscuit?
It's actually been longer than that. That came out in 2001, so it's actually been a decade.
So I can't quite believe that it's been that long since that book and since we talked, because I remembered having a good conversation with you about Seabiscuit, and of course it got a lot of attention. A lot of people liked the book. It inspired the movie, so I can't quite believe it's been all that time.
I can't either. It took me a very long time to do this book because it was such a sprawling story, and it was a lot of research, but boy, it was worth the time.
Yeah. And there are some interesting connections now between, you can certainly make some connections between the horse, the man, your life, some things that I'm sure that we'll talk about. It's my understanding that, in fact, you came across Louis Zamprini and his story when you were doing research for Seabiscuit.
Yeah, it was kind of a surprise to me that a horse led me to this subject, but Seabiscuit and Louis Zamperini were both very famous athletes at the same time in the mid to late 1930s, and they were both Southern California-based, so their articles on them were in the same newspapers, and I kept coming across stories on Louis, and it was before his war saga, but already his story was really amazing. He was an extraordinary athlete, and he had gone to the Olympics as a teenager. He had been a juvenile delinquent, and I wrote down his name in my Seabiscuit research notebook, and when I got done working on it, I gave him a call, and we had the most fascinating conversation I've ever had, and by the end of it, I knew this was my next subject.
Yeah. And this was a case where he, as you say, he was somebody who was well-known already, and he had written, I think, two versions of his own story. Do I remember reading somewhere him saying to you something like, well, I don't know what you're going to write about me and about my experiences that hasn't already been written?
Yeah, at first that was his reaction. And the thing is, he'd done an autobiography with other writers twice. But an autobiography, which is a great genre, is a very different thing than biography. And with the biography, I could broaden the story a whole lot and place him in history and interview all these people that had been through his experience with him, his fellow POWs, his fellow airmen, his fellow Olympians. I had access to interviews with a man who survived on the raft with him. And so there was actually a lot to tell, and I ended up being able to tell him things about his story that he never knew. So we had a wonderful time together.
Yeah, so you really feel that you managed to get at some things that were truly new, and even he would say, well, maybe at some level he knew that, but he might even say, well, I didn't really know that.
Yes, and he has said that a lot since I finished it and he read it. He was just really, really happy. There were so many things he didn't know, and it was a lot of fun to do.
He and I also understand he was really must have been very touched by the book and in a way moved by it, because I also read something about how he read the book and then he called you and said to you something like, you took me back, you put me back in Japan, or you put me back in the prisoner of war camp, and you said, well, I'm sorry about that. But he was so transported by his own story that it had that sort of effect on him.
Yeah, I was a little scared when I sent it to him. You know, you never know how someone's going to feel if you show them something you've written about their life. And he called me up that morning and said he had just finished it, and his voice was wavering. I think he was crying a little, and he said it was so real to him that he had to keep stopping every few minutes and looking out his window and saying, "I'm not there anymore. That's over. I'm in now." And that I told him I was sorry I'd put him through that, but it meant I'd gotten it right, and that was very gratifying to me.
Yeah, and we should underscore that he is still alive. He is this, and I think this month is going to turn 94.
He's about to turn 94. He's in marvelous shape. You know, he was born with an Olympian's body, and he's still got one at 94. He's in great shape.
And no doubt, if he hadn't had that kind of physical strength to start out with when he was a young man, he might not have survived either the crash or these 47 days at sea or this really incredibly horrific experience that he had as a prisoner of war.
It certainly helped him. I think he drew on both his superior body, but as well the experience he'd had as an elite athlete of enduring the kind of pain you go through as a middle distance runner to survive what he survived on the raft and in prison camp and in the plane crash. You're right.
Yeah. Just going back to talking about his early life, as you said, he was a juvenile delinquent. He got into a lot of trouble with the law. He did have apparently one skill that maybe if you're trying to evade the law was helpful. He could run. Was that something that he knew about early on?
I don't think he knew he was fast. And in fact, he had taken up smoking when he was a little boy. He was a very bad kid. He was a smoker and a drinker and a thief and a brawler. I mean, he was really a rebel. And because he was smoking as a kid, his friends actually called him mosquito lung because he had such poor stamina. But he was quite fast. And his brother saw that in him, and his brother kind of strong-armed him into trying running. And when he quit smoking and started training, they discovered that not only was he good at it, he was one of the best ever. I mean, he very likely would have been the first man to run a 4-minute mile had the war not intervened.
He actually, when he was in high school, he recorded the fastest mile ever for an American high schooler.
Yes, and it may have been the fastest mile ever run by anyone in the world in high school. And he really smashed the record, and he thought he could have gone faster. He was truly a superlative athlete.
So maybe no surprise that he ended up running for the U.S. Olympic team in the 36 Olympics.
Yeah, and he was just a teenager. He was the youngest distance athlete to ever make the U.S. Olympic team. And he did not win. He was not expected to. Finland was dominating in the 5,000 meters, which was the event he ran in. But he performed spectacularly, so much so that actually Hitler caught sight of him in this amazing rally that Louis made on the last lap and called him over and shook hands with him and said, "You're the boy with the fast finish." And Louis was a teenager, had no idea who Hitler was, had no idea he was shaking hands with a monster, but it was some kind of experience for him.
And that was certainly would have been a big experience, because this was now one of the most famous Olympic Games ever to be held because of the circumstances, because this was Nazi Germany and it was 1936, and Hitler was presiding over these games, and it's the games that's so well known because of the terrific performance by Jesse Owens.
Yes, and Jesse Owens was actually Louis's roommate and was a little older than Louis and took him under his wing, or tried to. Louis ended up getting in some trouble while he was there anyway, but Louis actually stole Jesse Owens's "Do Not Disturb" sign on his door, and as a result, Owens was getting woken up all night every night because people were seeking his signature. He still has the "Do Not Disturb" sign, by the way.
So what did he tell you some other good stories that came out of the Olympic experience?
Sure. Louis was kind of a serial thief, and everywhere he went in Germany, he was stealing things, souvenirs. And he actually saw there were Nazi banners hanging on the Chancellery building, and this was actually while Hitler was in the building. And Louis decided he wanted to steal one, and there were armed guards parading in front of the Chancellery. And while they were marching in a different direction, so their eyes were not on him, Louis ran over and tried to tear a flag down. He didn't succeed. He kept jumping and jumping, and he couldn't quite reach it. And the guards turned around, saw him, and told him to halt. And he took one last jump, tore down the flag, and ran, and heard a gunshot behind him. So he stopped, and they interrogated him. And he actually sort of sweet-talked him into not only letting him go, but allowing him to keep the flag, which he also still has.
And he still has, yeah, I've seen a picture of that, and he still has it. That's one of his souvenirs from that time.
It's very funny because in the 1930s press, this was covered as this sort of blow he was making against fascism, and this wasn't what Louis was doing at all. Louis was just trying to steal something, but it was elevated into this sort of political gesture that it wasn't.
Yeah. Our guest, just very quickly, let me reintroduce our guest for this hour, Laura Hillenbrand, and we're talking about her new book. It's titled Unbroken, a World War II story of survival, resilience, and redemption. And it's the story of this man here we've been talking about, Louis Zamperini. The book is just recently out, published by Random House. She's also the author of the big bestseller Seabiscuit, an American Legend, about the racehorse, Seabiscuit. So questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455, a toll-free 800-222-9455. So he volunteered for the Army Air Corps. I think this was actually at that time there was no Air Force, so it was the Army Air Corps. Did he have some particular interest in flying?
He actually had very few Americans had been in planes at that point, but he had been taken up as a boy in a little plane just for scenic purposes, as just a little passenger plane, and it terrified him. But after he got out of college, he worked at Lockheed, and he got to watch these fighter jets or fighter planes taking off from the runway, and he was fascinated by that. So he enlisted in the Air Corps and went into pilot training, and he got very airsick and very nervous up there, and he didn't enjoy it, and he ended up washing out of it. But he didn't look at these papers they asked him to sign when he washed out. This is prior to the beginning of the war. And one of the things he had signed said he was agreeing to rejoin the Air Corps if he were ever drafted, and he was drafted. And they sent him right back, and they made him into a bombardier. So he became an airman again.
And that, and being a bombardier, this is an important. I'm sure every member of the crew is important because some people fly the planes, and some people are there to fight off fighters if they're going to attack the plane. But if the mission is to drop bombs, then the bombardier is maybe one of the most important guys on the crew.
Yeah, basically the mission is to carry the bombardier to the target, and everybody else is there to protect him. And it's a very, very difficult job. They operated this thing called a Norden bombsight, which was a highly, highly secret computer that the Americans used. It was carried under guard everywhere. Airmen weren't allowed to photograph it or talk about it. And actually, while I was researching the book, I found someone who had one, and they brought it to my house and taught me how to use it. And it is very hard to use. And I was quite impressed with how good Louis must have been to be able to use this. And they were the best crew in their squadron in terms of their bombing scores. He was an extraordinary bombardier.
I think you've ended up learning a lot of things about planes and bombing and so forth. Tell me about the B-24, this plane that he was flying in.
The B-24 was a great big ugly plane that nobody wanted to fly in at the time. They called it the flying coffin. And it wasn't just because it did actually look like a flying coffin. It was a dangerous plane. There were a lot of problems with it, especially early on. It had a lot of mechanical problems. There was a rash of incidents in which the tails actually fell off the plane spontaneously. It was a difficult plane to fly. It was hard to handle. It was very heavy, very big. It was the heaviest plane in the world at the time. There were lots and lots of B-24 crashes. Training was exceptionally dangerous even before you get into combat. 15,000 personnel, Air Corps personnel, died stateside without ever going into combat in training. And a lot of these were in these B-24s. And once they got into combat theater, another 36,000 people died in accidents, not combat. So you really can't overstate how dangerous a job this was to be a bomber airman.
So what were the circumstances that day when the plane went down?
A plane the day before had disappeared. It had taken off on its way south across the Pacific and had not arrived at its destination. And Louis and his crew were scrambled to go hunt for it. And their plane had been severely damaged in a previous bombing mission. They actually had 600 holes in it, and they couldn't fly it anymore. So they were given a plane that nobody wanted to fly in. It was called Green Hornet. There was something the matter with this plane. When it flew, it was so underpowered that the tail would actually kind of drag under the nose. It was on the verge of stalling all the time. No one wanted to fly in it, but they were ordered to. So they went up, they went on this search, and one of the engines died on the plane. And the plane had so little power, it couldn't keep altitude with only three engines, which other healthier B-24s could. And in the scramble to save the plane, a second engine quit because a crewman hit a button that he shouldn't have hit. And with now only two engines both on one side, the plane couldn't stay in the air. And at very high speed, it spiraled into the ocean.
Yeah, so it wasn't a matter of being shot down.
No.
It was purely technical issues that brought the plane down.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. So the plane goes down, as I mentioned, that this is a big plane, and it had a big crew. It had a crew of 11. Only three guys made it?
Yeah, and they were all sitting on the right side of the plane. This was sort of an interesting thing. The co-pilot and pilot switched places during the sea search that they were doing because the co-pilot was trying to log hours in the pilot's position in order to qualify as a pilot. This was very frequently done. And this may have contributed to the chaos in the cockpit that resulted in this button being hit that caused an engine to quit. But the plane ended up spiraling in and hitting on its left side. And as a result, these three men on the right survived, but everyone on the left was killed. So it may have been that switch with the pilot and co-pilot that saved the pilot's life.
So it was three guys. It was Louis, it was the pilot, and the tail gunner.
Yes.
The guy who was at the machine guns in the tail of the plane. It was his job. Anybody who was going after them from behind, it was his job to shoot them down.
Yes.
Tell me about these other two guys.
The pilot was a man named Russell Allen Phillips. Everyone called him Phil. And he was Louis's best friend. They had been together since training. They roomed together. They had very compatible personalities. Louis was very outgoing, and Phil was very quiet, and they worked very well together that way. And Phil was a superb pilot and a very reliable kind of man, a very understated but competent person. The tail gunner was the man they called Mac, Francis McNamara. And he was a guy who was a little bit flippant, a little bit of a party guy when they were at base. They didn't know him very well. He was a recent addition to the crew because a number of men had been wounded in an earlier battle. And it was an interesting thing once they got in the water how differently they dealt with it. But Louis and Phil handled the crash well, handled the aftermath, ending up on this life raft well. But McNamara was pretty much emotionally falling apart right from the start. It was interesting how that went.
And he didn't survive. He died after about a month when they were on the raft?
Yes. All three men lost a tremendous amount of weight. They were trying to survive out there by catching fish, which they had a very hard time doing, and occasionally birds that would land on the raft or land on their heads, and they would snatch them and break their necks and eat them. But it just wasn't enough food. They had almost no water. They were just catching rainwater. They were really in trouble that way. There was a little bit of chocolate stored on the raft for emergencies, but on the first night, McNamara panicked, and he ate it. And so they had nothing to eat from then on except what they could catch. So the men lost more and more weight. They lost half their body weight. But McNamara seemed to do the worst. He lost the most weight. He did the worst emotionally, and he just dwindled down to nothing, and then he died on the 33rd day.
Yeah. So you when you read the story, it's amazing, first of all, that these three guys survived the crash, and then there was a life raft that they managed to get to so that they at least weren't in the water. But you have to, when you look at the stuff that was on the life raft, you have to think that as far as the military was concerned, they were thinking, if guys manage to survive and they get in the life raft, if we don't get to them within a couple of days, well we're not going to get to them. So it wasn't, I don't know if it was it anybody's idea that somebody would be living one of these things for days, and certainly not, you know, maybe a couple of days, and certainly not more than a month?
I don't think more than a month, no. I think they thought people could survive maybe for a couple of weeks, and some people did. They never anticipated that three guys would be on a raft for 47 days. It wasn't the entire 47 for poor McNamara, but for Louis and Phil, it was 47 days. 2,000 miles they drifted. And by that time, the raft was falling apart. It was turning into jelly. And the raft was dyed a bright yellow, and the dye had come off of the raft and had gotten on the men. So the men were just canary yellow. It was very odd-looking. The raft was very poorly equipped. Later in the war, rafts were much better equipped. They had stills on them, so people would have a continuous but very small source of water. They had more food. They had little radios on them. These things were not on this the raft that they got into.
And you think, probably there are some people who think, looking at this experience, that it may be that this 47 days on this raft could in fact be the record, that there was nobody who went for longer than these guys.
There is no record of anyone surviving longer than, I believe it was 34 days prior to this, in an inflatable raft. Mm-hmm. There were other raft events where people were in wooden or metal boats that did survive, but 47 days was way, way beyond any record I could find of anyone surviving. If anyone did survive longer, they didn't make it. They didn't live to tell about it in the end.
Yeah. Well, and as you say, it sounds as if they had to go too much longer, the raft itself would have just disintegrated.
Yeah. It in the middle of their experience out there, a plane went over, and they fired a flare, and the plane turned back, and they thought they were being rescued. What they didn't know was that it was a Japanese plane, and it came back and it strafed them. It made many, many runs over the top of the raft and machine gunned them. And at first, all three men dove off the raft and hid underneath, and then they all got back in again. And when the Japanese bomber came back again, only Louis was strong enough to go back in the water. And the Japanese were just running bullet holes all the way through the raft, but somehow didn't hit any of the men. Louis was being literally attacked by sharks when he was down in the water. He was hitting them with his hands and with his feet to try to keep them away during each bomber pass. And eventually the Japanese flew off. The rafts were covered in holes. The men were okay, but they had to patch the rafts. And then from the rest of the journey, these patches were barely holding on, and they were having to keep repumping air into the raft. It was very scary, and by the end of the journey, the patches were bubbling up like they were about to burst. They wouldn't have lasted more than a few more days.
It's just, at various points along the story, you just say, that's incredible, and then you just go on to another part where you say, that's even more incredible.
Yes.
Just the idea that they would be on the raft all this time. They had no food. They had no water. There were sharks in the water, and then a plane comes along and starts shooting at them and puts holes in the raft. And still, they managed to survive. Unfortunately, they were picked up by the Japanese, and they went into prison camps. But at least at that point, it's just remarkable even to that point.
It's truly incredible, yeah. I mean, at two junctures in this story, the sharks, there were very big sharks circling the raft the entire time the men were out there. The sharks were actually leaping up onto the raft trying to drag the men into the water, and they were taking their oars and whacking the sharks in the nose. And this happened especially when the raft was sinking immediately after the strafing, where they had a little air pump, and Louis was working the air pump, and he's patching the raft, and the other two men are smashing at the sharks trying to keep them away. And this is a terrible struggle for a few days where the sharks were constantly trying to pull them off, but fortunately they didn't succeed.
We're at our midpoint here. Our guest is Lori Hillenbrand. Her new book is Unbroken, a World War II story of survival, resilience, and redemption. It's published by Random House. It's just recently out. She's also the author of the big bestseller that came out a decade ago, Seabiscuit, an American Legend. That book was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award, won some other awards, inspired a film. And this is her new book, which is just out, which has also been, I understand, somebody wants to try to make a movie of this, although somebody's been wanting to make a movie of Louis Zamprini's story for some time.
Yes.
It hasn't happened yet, but who knows?
Yeah, it looks like it's going to happen now with Universal Studios.
All right. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. So, and if people, I really think people should pick up the book and look at it. So if they make their way through that harrowing story of how these guys actually, ultimately two of them, managed to make it to be picked up by the Japanese, then the next remarkable section is his experience as a POW. And there's nothing else to be said except for the fact that the treatment of prisoners of war by the Japanese was extremely brutal. One really telling statistic is that, as I've read, is that in Europe, one of every 100 prisoners of war died. Of those held by the Japanese, it was almost one in three.
Yes. It was... They were extraordinarily brutal to their prisoners of war, and they really thought nothing of murdering them. They enslaved them. Louis became a slave. They did medical experiments upon them. But one of the amazing things that came out of this is that this is not simply this horrible, grim story because of the POWs themselves, Louis included. There was a whole underground network of defiance in these POW camps, and Louis was a big participant in this. They stole from their captors. They did a lot of things to fool and trick their captors. They stole food. They stole newspapers to get information, which was really important to POW morale because they didn't know what was happening in the war. And it was very important to know that the Allies were winning and they were coming for them. One of the things that the POWs knew is that the Japanese had plans to murder all of them if the Allies came close enough to recapture them. And toward the end of the war, the men in Louis' camp learned what their death date was. It was going to be August 22nd, 1945. There was this gathering tension among the POWs, and they were doing everything they could to steal information to find out what was going on.
And they knew who he was, or at least they knew he had been this Olympic athlete, so that they knew he was a significant person. So for that reason, they felt that they couldn't just kill him, but that also meant that he was singled out for particularly unpleasant treatment.
Yeah, they initially they held him on a place called Kwajalein Island, which is in the Marshall Islands, and it was known by the Allies as Execution Island because virtually every POW who was taken there was murdered. And they initially condemned Louis and the pilot Phil to execution there, and then at the last moment they changed their minds because they realized as an Olympic athlete, Louis could be a propagandist for them. So what they decided to do was to send him to Japan, to the POW camps there, and make life a living hell for him so that he would agree to betray his country. And so that's what they did.
And that was something that he did not do.
Louis refused. Initially, they allowed him to make a broadcast to tell his family he was still alive. He had been declared dead, as had Phil, his pilot. And his poor mother, when she learned he had disappeared, this rash broke out on her hands and stayed there for the rest of the war. Her hands had these weeping sores all over them. It was purely psychological from her distress, but she did not believe he was dead. But the military had stopped looking for him. Well, Louis wanted to make this broadcast so he could tell her he was alive, and he did make a broadcast. They did not make him say anything anti-American in the broadcast, but then they brought him back a second time, and they wanted him to read a very anti-American propaganda piece to demoralize American troops, and he refused to do it, and so they said they were sending him to punishment camp, and what they did was they sent him back, and his life became much, much worse.
Yeah, and there was, is this story, as we've said, that the treatment, generally, the treatment of prisoners of war by the Japanese was extremely brutal. He had the misfortune to come into the care of a man named Mutsuhiro Watanabe, who was particularly bad and seemed to derive great pleasure from brutalizing Louis.
Yes. He was known as, excuse me, the Bird. It was a nickname that the POWs had given him. Excuse me. And he was truly a monster. He was a psychopath, a very, very wealthy, very handsome young man who was obsessed with punishing POWs. And he was particularly obsessed with Louis. He was very jealous of Louis because Louis was famous and Louis was an officer. And for the rest of the war, it was kind of a showdown between Louis and this man trying to break him, and Louis doing everything he could to resist and defy. And it ended up being quite a fascinating struggle between these two men.
Yeah. So how, again, you know, after having had the story of how he and the pilot from the plane survived in this inflatable raft, which was slowly disintegrating for 47 days, lost a lot of weight, were exposed to the elements, amazing just the fact that they just survived that. So coming off of that, then the next thing is he spends these 2 years in the prison camp. And once again, you just have to ask yourself, how is it that he managed to survive? What is it about him that he could get through this experience?
Yeah, it's the question that was kind of informing the whole book for me, is what is it that's special about this man and the other men around him who managed to get through this? Louis is kind of a virtuoso of optimism. I mean, he's somebody who, even when he was a kid, was a tremendously optimistic person. He would get into all of these troubles, but would always be sure he'd get out of them. He was also a very, very resourceful man. He could figure out how to catch a fish with his lieutenant's pin on the raft, or to how to gather water using the case for the air pump on the raft, and things like that. He was very good at figuring out how to survive out there. And he was also someone who did a good job at hanging on to his dignity. Being defiant, while it often brought more trouble to him, was something that helped him hang on to his dignity. And I really found with these POWs that the most important thing about survival for them was to maintain their dignity, that once that went, men died right away. Well, Louis was able to defy his captors over and over again, and I think that's why he came out of it.
Mm. So you, now, in the process of doing this book, you spend a lot of time talking with him. Is this something that it seems like it's easy for him to talk about, difficult for him to talk about? And what is it like for you to be sitting there and listening to him tell the story?
It was really interesting. I was nervous when I first talked to him. You know, how do you ask a man about experiences that are this traumatic? And what startled me about him is that he spoke so easily of what he had been through and about monstrous men who had tormented him and enslaved him and really driven him to the end of his wits. And I asked him, you know, how is it you can speak of these things so easily? And he said, I can because I forgave them. And that was the hook for me, that I wanted to find out how a man could forgive the unforgivable and how could he survive the unsurvivable. And all the way through our experiences, there were very few places where it seemed difficult for him to talk about experiences. He has come to peace with what happened to him. And I think that that's the greatest thing of all about his story. It wasn't what he went through at the time. It's how he has come to peace with it since.
I hope you wouldn't mind if I asked you to talk just a little bit about yourself, just because your experience connects in some ways with both of the things that you've written about, I think. It's something that you've talked about, so it's not something you've been shy about talking about.
Sure, yes.
And I know that really you want the attention to be on him and on the project, not so much on you. But it's something that I think I'd like to have people hear about and have you talk a little bit about, and also because I'm sure that it was very much a part of the challenge of writing the book.
Yes.
So the issue here is that you have chronic fatigue syndrome, and have had since you were in college.
Yes.
Now, and I don't know how much people know about that or what the associations they have when they hear that, but I do know it's something that is not very well understood and often dismissed. So for you, the fact that you have this thing, this challenge that you live with, what does that mean for you in your life?
Yeah, it's actually, I like talking about it in that I want to help people understand it because the name is so misleading. This is a devastating disease. It knocked me out of college in 1987. I was never able to go back. I never got well. But it causes fevers and sweats and chills and extreme light sensitivity. And more than anything else, exhaustion that is incredibly profound, where you will get so tired, you can't sit up, you can't speak, you can't raise your arms. And I've gone through a number of several years long periods where I literally can't get down my staircase. I can't do it. The house could burn down around me and I'd have to burn in it because I couldn't get out. It really causes a kind of exhaustion that healthy people can't really understand. And as a result, it's extraordinarily incapacitating. I've really been housebound for 24 years, pretty much. And actually, in the middle of working on this book in 2007, I had a terrible relapse of the illness, and it was 2 years before I was strong enough to leave my house. It was many months before I got downstairs again. So it definitely made it an adventure to try to write this book. It's why it took me so long. At times I am so weak I can barely sit up and I can just get my hands to the keyboard and keep writing. But it was definitely difficult. It was in its way an advantage to have had a history like this though, because I explained it to Louis. I actually sent him an article I wrote for The New Yorker about what this illness has been like for me. And he felt that because I had been through what I've been through, that I understood suffering. And he's told me a number of times that helped him to completely open up to me about what he had been through in the war and in the aftermath of the war. And I felt that with a lot of the POWs that I interviewed and a lot of the airmen, it was easier to kind of get them to open up their memories to me. But it did make it a very slow and arduous and painful process for me to write the book.
And what that means, and I certainly don't want to take anything away from the book or the project, but in practical terms, what that meant for all of the interviews you did and for all of this time that you spent with Louis, all of that you did on the telephone. So
yeah.
You've never actually met Louis Zamperini.
I have never been in a room with Louis Zamperini, no. And it's very strange because we've spent hundreds of hours on the phone together. And I've looked at so much video of him and so many photographs, and I've read all his letters, and I feel like I know him better than I know myself, almost. And it is kind of funny that we haven't met in person. But in a really strange way, that turned out to be kind of an advantage, because when I was speaking to him and when he's telling me stories from 1927 or 1943 or 1953, I was able to picture him at that age. I wasn't seeing an elderly man talking to me. I was seeing the kid, the young man who went through these experiences, and in a way that helped me to fully realize it in my imagination, maybe more than I could have had I been there with him.
Mm. I wonder if for your publishers, have they ever actually said to you, gosh, Laura, you know, it'd really be nice if we could send you out on book tour. And maybe they understand to the point where they wouldn't even say such a thing, they must wish that you could promote. I mean, I'm really happy to be talking to you, and I hope that you're well. But I'm sure that they would, in their heart of hearts, they would like to be able to send you out.
I'm sure they would, yeah. I mean, it was See This Kid also. I was healthier then with See This Kid, and I was able to make a couple of local brief public appearances, but really, it was only two. Everything else was done via the phone or via TV interviews in my home. And this time around, I'm a lot sicker, and I've only been able to do a tiny bit of promotion. They have been so kind about it. They understand what I deal with, and they're very compassionate about it. And they don't push me. They let me set the parameters that I need to set.
So now people have heard a little bit of Louis' story. They've heard a little bit of your story. Maybe they are familiar with Seabiscuit and that story. And there is a way that you can hook all these things up, or at least I would expect that for you there would be particular resonance, ways in which you would feel personally you could connect with both the man and the horse.
Yeah, I'm interested in stories about individuals overcoming great difficulties for obvious reasons. I mean, this is a real fascination with me. I want to know how others do it and how people get out of the different kinds of captivity that people get into, the literal kinds of captivity like Louis was in or other kinds of traps in the world. And where do they find it within themselves to overcome great hardship? And that's where these two stories meet. I mean, they're very different, a racehorse and a POW. But in their essence, they're both very, very inspiring stories of individuals that did overcome. And in Seabiscuit's case, it was the people around him as well as the horse. And Louis, I have never heard of an individual overcoming as much as Louis did. And he is truly a peaceful, happy man now.
We are coming into about our last 10 minutes. Laura Hillenbrand is the guest. She's the author of the bestseller Seabiscuit, An American Legend, and also her new book is Unbroken, a World War II story of survival, resilience, and redemption. It's published by Random House, and if you have been listening along, you know it's the story of this man, Louis Zamperini. In May of 1943, he was the bombardier on a B-24 that went down in the Pacific. Out of a crew of 11, three men survived. He was one of them. He and the pilot spent 47 days on an inflatable life raft that by the time that they were rescued, put that in quotes, by the Japanese, was falling apart. He spent 2 years as a prisoner of war and survived all of that and managed to come home and is still alive. It's turning 94 this month. And it's really a remarkable story. Just now to sort of round the story out, he manages to survive all that. He comes home. His family has been told that he was dead. He had to say the least, he had a difficult time.
Yes. His time was very typical of prisoners of war who came home. The war doesn't end when the guns stop firing, and these men had been through some pretty horrific things that they were just barely able to get through. And when the dust settled, they had to deal with that emotional aftermath. And Louis completely fell apart. He began having flashbacks where he would suddenly be back in the war again. He would experience hallucinations where there were lice or fleas wriggling on his skin that weren't actually there. He began to drink very heavily. He became an alcoholic. He became a violent guy. He was just terrible to his wife a lot of the time, and she came to the point of wanting to divorce him. And he became fixated on returning to Japan to murder the bird, the Japanese guard who had tortured him so badly. And he began to devote his whole life to trying to raise the money to get back there. He was going to strangle him. And everything reached a crisis one night when he woke up straddling his pregnant young wife and trying to strangle her, thinking that she was the bird. And fortunately, he woke up in time when she screamed, and he didn't hurt her, but that was as bad as it got.
Mm. So, and it hurt. So the way this gets resolved, apparently at her urging, he went this was in 1949. Billy Graham was in town there in Los Angeles. He was having an event. He went there, had a conversion experience, and says that from that point on, his life was completely different.
Yeah, I don't want to give away too much of what happened, but there was a beautiful thing happened to him when he went into this tent in Los Angeles and heard Billy Graham speak. Something that Billy Graham said enabled him to kind of reconceptualize everything that had happened to him. And when he did that, this rage that he had simply vanished, and he came to a place of peace, and he became the very happy man he still is today.
Yeah, so for however people feel about religion, Christianity, Billy Graham, you know, whatever, that for this man, for Louis Zamperini, that was the thing, faith was the thing that came along and really made this enormous difference in his life, to the point where, and this is, again, an amazing part of the story, here he went from having this plan, what he wanted to do was go back to Japan and kill this guy, this man that had tortured him in the POW camp. He actually wrote him a letter about how he forgave him. Yeah. And apparently somebody said that they could get the letter to this man, Watanabe, who died 7 years ago. And nobody knows if he actually got it, but his intention was to actually say to him, I forgive you.
Yes. I'm pretty sure Watanabe did get that letter.
Oh, he did get the letter.
I'm pretty sure. I don't know it for absolute sure, but a person who could reach him said he would get it to him. Mm. But he did not respond. He was not a changed man by the end of his life.
So that's just, again, that's another one of these points where you say that's just having been through all of that, that you could get to that point where you could make peace with that whole business, and when you could do something like that, again, seems pretty remarkable.
Yes, it's extraordinary.
So then he went on to, Louis went on to be a motivational speaker. He worked with kids who were in trouble. So that was really that was the thing that gave direction to his life after that.
Yes, he opened a camp for wayward boys, as they called them, which is something he certainly used to be. And that's really been the focus of his life since then, doing these, going around and speaking about his experiences and guiding these kids. And he's had a very wonderful life since finally coming to peace about the war.
Yeah. And he, if people are interested in seeing him, as we've said, he was somebody, because of his various experiences in the war, because of his experiences as an Olympic athlete and so forth, was somebody who was actually well known. Now, maybe more people will know about him now, but certainly people knew who he was. And if you go, you can go to YouTube and go places like that, and you can see him. You can see footage of him, and you can see interviews with him now, today. And so you can get a sense of this guy and see him talk and see what he looks like now on the on the eve of his 94th birthday.
On my website, www.unbroken-book.com, I have a video of him there, and it's wonderful to see him. He looks terrific for a 94.
Yeah, it really has impressed me. You know, we should all be doing that good. It's significantly short of 94, but to be in that kind of shape, you just have to say, you know, more power to him.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you think now that is he ending up maybe as a result of the book getting some additional recognition? As I said, he was already somebody who really, you know, people knew who he was. He was always something of a celebrity, and he carried the Olympic torch when the Olympics were in Los Angeles. So he was somebody who, and because of his career he had as a speaker, was somebody who was well known. Does this further bringing recognition to him, do you think?
Yes, he has. I talk to him all the time, and he says the phone is just ringing off the hook, that everybody wants to talk to him, everybody wants him to come speak. I think he's really enjoying it, actually. I think it might be a little bit overwhelming for other people, but for Louis, it's all in stride. But yes, he's the book has sold very well, and the more the book sells, the more people know who he is and want to get in touch with him. And I think he's enjoyed telling his story again, and the recognition and the chance to maybe help people out in their lives. That's what his life's been about.
And as we said a little earlier, along the way, along the years, a number of people have wanted to make a movie about him and this experience, and somebody has picked up the option on your book, and you think that now finally that there actually will be a movie about him?
There's you never can say for sure, but there's been a lot of enthusiasm about it, and I certainly hope so. It's cinematically, the potential with this story is really amazing. I mean, with plane crashes and the Olympics and everything else, but I know a lot of people want to make it out there, and hopefully they will. It'll be fun to watch if they do it.
Yeah. Well, we're coming down here. We have a couple of minutes left, and you know, if you talked a little bit about your circumstances, you worked on this for 7 years, you've kind of had some ups and downs with your health, and there were some times when it was really difficult. So this was a major project, and it took a long time. And you know, at this point in interviews, interviewers always say, "So, what's your next project going to be?" Given just how I realize that's a big question to ask, have you been thinking about maybe what you might like to write about next?
The first thing on my agenda is to rest. once this all comes to an end, I do need a very long rest. I pushed myself much too hard in the last 7 years. But after that, I do have something possibly in mind that I actually came across while researching this. But I have to see if it would really pan out as a book. I have to do research on it, but hopefully it will. It looked like an interesting story to me, but I'm not telling.
I respect that. And having done a lot of interviews and asked that question, often that's what writers will say. Well, you know, there is something that I'm kind of thinking about, and I think it could be pretty interesting, but I'd rather not. So that's perfectly fine. But I would expect it, knowing the kinds of things that you're interested in, one might think that it would be another. Maybe it would be another story that had the kind of themes of resilience and redemption and survival, to quote the subtitle, that obviously interested you in these two stories. Oddly enough, you know, about man and a horse, but again, you there are ways that the things get all tied up together thematically, I think.
Yes, and every writer has specific things they're interested in, and I have mine, as you can tell if you read both my books. You can tell what I'm interested in. And I'm always looking for things that are personally inspiring to me, and hopefully I'll find something that'll hit me between the eyes again, like these first two did.
Well, I certainly wish you well. I thank you very much for giving us some of your time. We certainly appreciate it. If people, by the way, would like to listen to the interview that we did, now I say 10 years ago, I can't quite believe it, but yes, we talked about Seabiscuit when that book was just out. That's on our website. And if people would like to go back and listen to the interview, and certainly they could go back and read the book, because it's a really good story. And also take a look at this book, Unbroken, A World War II Story of Survival, Resilience, and Redemption, published by Random House, by our guest, Laura Hillenbrand. And just, I want to say just thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me on. It was a lot of fun.
And you've been listening to
WILL.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. January 5th, it was first broadcast. A lot of past shows are available anytime you want to hear them. Just go to will.illinois.edu.
WILL programs are made possible by Community Concierge and American Concierge magazines. Every issue includes an event calendar, attractions, and a business and shopping guide. Concierge magazines are distributed throughout Central Illinois and always present the Champaign-Urbana and Bloomington-Normal areas at their best.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll have more Focus. Celeste Quinn will be doing the show we call Computers and You, but before that, we'll have our update on the markets.
Agricultural information on WILL is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers, because everything they do starts with you.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the markets, where at mid-session, prices have pretty much traded both sides of the open and currently are showing a lot of red on the screen. Let's look at some particulars. In Kansas City, March wheat now at 950 and a half, down 2 and a quarter. May 9, 16¾ down 3. July 9, 68¼ down 3. March wheat at the Board of Trade 8, 58¼ down 4¼, now down 5. May 8, 88½ down 5½. July 9, 09½ down 5¼. March corn 6, 65¾ down 3½. May 6, 76¼ down 3½, now down 3¼. July 6, 81 down 3½. December 5, 93¾ down 4. March soybeans 14, 42 down 2. May 14, 52¼ down 1¾. July 14, 56¼.